Good morning. We will hear this morning United States against Dacus. Counsel for the defense.
Please support. My name is Captain Patrick Grant. Together with Colonel O'Brien, we represent the appellant, Staff Sergeant Brandon Dacus. The military judge abused his discretion by accepting appellant's guilty plea to the two specifications of aggravated assault because during the Providence inquiry and sentencing, appellant admitted facts and introduced evidence that is substantially inconsistent with a means likely to produce death or grievous bodily harm. The likelihood of death or grievous bodily harm is measured by the risk of harm and the magnitude of harm. Turning to the risk of harm first, the risk of harm must be more than merely fanciful, speculative, or remote. During the Providence inquiry in regards to Specification 1, the military judge asked the appellant, did you have sexual intercourse with Staff Sergeant H.G.? To which the appellant stated, to a certain degree, yes. He then had to confer with the defense counsel. He then added, it was an attempt to, but it was a slight penetration, not deep penetration. It was just an attempt. My penis did not get erect. It was an attempt, and I was wearing a condom. He later told the military judge that he did not ejaculate. The appellant did agree with the military judge that it could transmit that the HIV virus could be transmitted even when wearing a condom and not ejaculating through pre-ejaculate fluid. However, during sentencing, appellant then went on to introduce evidence from Dr. Mark Wallace, who stated that the risk of appellant transmitting the HIV virus is extremely low. The defense qualified Dr. Wallace as an expert in AIDS and infectious medicine. Dr. Wallace testified that the risk of transmitting the HIV virus is a function of the viral load. For example, Dr. Wallace stated that someone with a viral load of 38,000 would have a 1 in 450 chance of transmitting the HIV virus. Conversely, someone with a much lower viral load of 1,700 would have a 1 in 10,000 chance of transmitting the HIV virus.
Didn't he stipulate that the risk of transmitting, that the possibility of transmission was greater than fanciful or remote? Wasn't that in the stipulation?
I believe it was, Your Honor, but then he's going on and introducing this evidence that's essentially saying it is fanciful or remote. This is inconsistent with what's in the statement, with what he's...
Your argument is not that he didn't admit it, that there's inconsistent stuff.
That it's a substantial inconsistency, Your Honor.
How do you get, I understand the case law is responsible for this, so it's not you, but how does one get from natural and probable consequence to risk of harm to something that is merely more than merely a fanciful or remote possibility? Let me try that again. How does probable consequence get translated into more than merely fanciful?
I'm not sure what you're asking. Are you...
Well, if the statute, if the article or the article is likely to produce, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the discussion or definition says natural and probable consequence.
Yes, Your Honor.
And now when we're assessing risk of harm, everybody's debating over whether it's merely fanciful.
Yeah,
are those all coterminous?
Well, Your Honor, again, the court in the past has seemed to divide it into the risk and magnitude of harm. And it seems magnitude means that the consequence of death or grievous bodily harm must be probable rather than possible. Whereas the risk just needs to be merely more than fanciful, speculative, or remote.
But you're happy with that definition?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, if I were an English teacher and someone said, give me a definition of probable or give me a definition of likely, and they said, well, that's something that's more than fanciful, I'd say, that's nuts. Right? That's not the definition of probable.
I think, too, maybe this is coming from Witherspoon, where the court has said that if the magnitude is high and the risk is low, it's sort of a balancing. You can still have an aggravated assault.
Well, I think what Judge Baker is asking you, and maybe you're not understanding his question, is we understand what Witherspoon says, and I think what he's saying is, do you agree that what Witherspoon says is consistent with the language of the statute as a matter of first impression?
Well,
And if you'd like to address it on rebuttal, that's fine.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I haven't really given that matter thought.
I'm trying to understand the law. I'm not, that may have nothing to do with this case in the context of the plea, but when I do my TikTok and I start with the article and I end up with something fanciful, I'm like, wait, how's that go? And I understand that it stops off at Weatherspoon and dances around with Johnson and so on.
Yes.
Now, how do you deal with the fact you're in a plea case?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in Johnson, one of those cases, they said that the likelihood is a question of fact for the fact finder. Your client pled out here. I guess you're going to argue that it's still a matter inconsistent, right? But if you want to take this on, why didn't you contest it?
That's correct, Your Honor. But this is, as you said, in the context of the guilty plea, where the military judge in Article 45 and 910H2 has a duty to resolve substantial inconsistencies. And that's all I'm arguing here, is that the appellant, through Dr. Wallace's testimony, when you combine that with what he told the military judge in regards to South Sergeant HG, is raising substantial inconsistencies.
But the doctor, the expert, or whatever, said it is possible.
But the doctor also said the risk is extremely low. And he said that on three occasions.
Well, he said more than that. He said it's very, very unlikely.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which probably is not the definition of likely. but I don't know. I mean, it depends what we say. But why didn't the doctor also said it's extremely, but it is possible.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The doctor did say, well, very, very unlikely, it is possible.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you've already accepted all this fanciful stuff. It's a plea, so it's possible.
Your Honor, possible was not the standard here.
What is the standard? He said more than a remote possibility was the standard, and the doctor said it was possible.
He does say it's possible, Your Honor. He also says when someone like a parent who has a viable like a parent, if they actually do transmit the HIV virus, that is remarkable. And he also said for a parent to transmit it, it's very unlikely. The risk is very low. And he also testified, and I know there's an inconsistency in the government's brief on page 12, where the government states that he advised a married man with a low viral load not to have sex with his wife on page 103.
It matters inconsistent in the testimony of the doctor.
Yeah, and I'm getting there. That's not what he said. He said that someone with a low viral load, like a parent, what he advises them to do is gain informed consent from their partner and to use a condom. In other words, what he's telling them is, as long as you use a condom, the risk is so low that you can have sex, because as this court knows, a victim can't consent.
It's possible to spread it.
But he's saying the risk is so low that it's okay for someone like a parent to have sex as long as he uses a condom. And he's also talking about the risk of a parent is extremely low. And when you look at the Reiki Uganda numbers that the doctor testified to, and when you consider what a parent's viral load is, a parent then tells the military judge that a parent's viral load can't even be detected. They therefore know it's below 50, but more than none. And when you apply, when I applied the Reiki Uganda's numbers to a parent's viral load, the risk of transmitting the disease to Staff Sergeant CH would be 1 in 340,000 for each time that they had sexual intercourse. And when you look at the doctor also said the risk is reduced by an additional 80 to 95% when you use a condom. So in regards to Staff Sergeant HG, the numbers that I came up with would be 1 in 614,000 for each time, well, for the one time that they had sexual intercourse with Staff Sergeant HG. That's where the doctor is essentially saying that the risk is extremely low. He's saying, yes, it's possible, but it's merely fanciful, speculative, or remote, that possibility.
What should the judge have done? This is basically evidence in mitigation. It's being put in sentencing and mitigation. Should the judge have reopened the plea then?
Yes, under 910H, that's exactly what the military judge should have done, to resolve that substantial inconsistency with the appellant.
I mean, I think it sounds to me that what you're really arguing is that as a matter of law, you're client could not have been found guilty.
No, Your Honor, that's not what I'm arguing. I'm not asking for a per se finding that 612,000 is remote. I'm only saying that this is a substantial inconsistency that the military judge did not resolve.
Well, how How is it a substantial inconsistency? Why don't you walk me through that?
Well, first of all, yes, combined with what? In specification one, where the appellant telling the military judge, my penis was not erect, that was
wrong. I'm familiar with the facts.
But when you combine that with what the doctor's saying, with the risk being extremely low, when you use a condom, the risk is reduced by 80 to 90%. When he advises similar patients to that have a similar appellant's viral load, that it's okay for them to have sex as long as they use a condom and receive informed consent. Because a victim can't consent to aggravated assault, essentially what the doctor is saying here is that the risk is so low if you use a condom, it's fine for a appellant to have sex.
Skip past all those facts. Isn't the inconsistency, if there is one, the fact that the article says likely to produce death or grievous bodily harm, and the doctor says it would be very, very unlikely that he would transmit it this way?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that is the inconsistency, if it exists at all.
Yes, Your Honor. He's saying extremely unlikely.
Well, if that's inconsistent, why then wouldn't it be subject to a motion to dismiss the charge? If, as the conversation has indicated, the problem is that unlikelihood, based on the doctor's testimony, doesn't meet the statutory definition. That's why I'm having a little trouble following your position in response to the questions here.
Yes, Your Honor. If this were a contested trial, this would...
I'm not talking about a contested trial.
Are you talking about...
In response to the question that was asked, you said that it's inconsistent for him to be convicted under a legal theory that relies on a means likely to produce.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the testimony was, in your view, that there was not a means likely to produce.
Yes.
Why wouldn't that be subject then to a motion to dismiss?
A motion to dismiss at the trial?
Right. In other words, that goes back to the question that was asked earlier, and that is, aren't you suggesting here that there's a legal deficiency here, that the testimony that he gave is not merely something that he might have raised for the fact finder's consideration, but that the evidence on the record was insufficient to establish the charge?
Because even if the military judge had reopened the providency inquiry, okay, what you're saying is that the doctor's testimony made it such that he could not have pled guilty. Because it was very, very unlikely. I mean, at least that's what I'm hearing you say.
Or that the evidence was factually insufficient. His load is so low that it couldn't even constitute aggravated assault. I mean, you know, leaving aside the likely and grievous bodily harm, you had consent here, at least to intercourse. Perhaps this wasn't even aggravated assault. Now, that's a legal question, but...
Yeah, well, I'm certainly not arguing factual insufficiency, but...
No, I know you are.
I really am trying to limit my argument to the context of Article 45 here. Whether or not if the military judge would have reopened the providence inquiry, could appellant be providence? I don't know. I mean, we're certainly not there. Those aren't the facts before the court.
But that's something we have to consider. If you're saying that the military judge failed in his duty, what would have happened if he reopened the inquiry? He reopened the inquiry and the accused said, yeah, I understand all that. At that point, is there a basis for a conviction?
I would say in this case, no, there is not, Your Honor.
So now you're arguing legal insufficiency.
I would say if that happened, yes, Your Honor.
Well, you're not arguing. The whole point was the judge should have gotten to the point where that could have been addressed.
Yes, Your Honor. And that simply never happened. He never met his duty under 910H. He never reopened the providence inquiry.
But we have to know what the consequences are. For example, there are probably in every guilty plea case in which evidence is introduced in sentencing and mitigation, something is said in sentencing which a juror somewhere could have considered and come up with a different verdict. Is that our standard for busting a plea?
First of all, it has to be a substantial inconsistency, but I think maybe if you reopen the providence here...
But inconsistent as to what? That is, what has to be raised in the providence inquiry with respect to the legal standard under which someone would be convicted that says that the judge erred in not allowing that to be? Is it simply any fact that is inconsistent with the finding of guilt?
No, Your Honor, this is simply more than any fact. This is a number of facts that negate an element of the offense here, Your Honor.
Well, again, I'm trying to figure out what ballpark we're in, because you say it negates an element of offense, and it would have been subject to a motion to dismiss, and he could not have pled guilty in this case under any circumstance. And that would be the issue before us.
My argument didn't go that far to say that appellant couldn't be provident if the military judge reopened the providence inquiry.
You're saying it could have been provident if the judge had done the right thing?
If the military judge reopens the providence inquiry,
right,
and the appellant's willing to say that, despite my new viral, yes, absolutely, the risk is more than a fanciful speculative of a note. If the appellant's willing to say
that's
that.
The stand.
But he's already said that.
And the doctor said it as well. Yeah. The doctor says on 101, now, in your medical opinion, is it possible for him to transmit the AIDS virus? And he's using arguably normal English there. And the answer is unquestionably yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
How is unquestionably yes put a judge on notice that says, oh, gosh, this is... Because you've got a problem with this fanciful stuff.
Yes, it's because of that. What is the degree of that unquestionably yes possibility? Because he also says it's remarkable when that does happen, that the risk is extreme, though. So it's very low.
But then the answer is, if you want to contest that and battle that out, go battle it out.
Yes, Your Honor, but that...
Don't plead guilty, then.
Right. We're rummaging around here in the wasteland of fancifulness and de minimis and God knows what else.
Yes, sir.
And as Judge Baker said, both the expert and the accused admitted that it was more than a scintilla, more than a fanciful and remote possibility. So where are we?
All I'm saying, Your Honor, is that even though he says it's unquestionable, you still have him saying that the risk is extremely low, it's very low, and you have him saying a punch viral is undetectable.
What is the standard? Is it a scintilla? Is it fancifulness? What is it?
This court's already said it's been a speculative fanciful
okay.
remote. And this is what he's essentially telling the military judge here when he says it's remarkable that it does, if it does happen, and that if he uses a condom, it's fine for him to have sex. Because it's essentially saying the risk
You're is... You're not asking us to change the standard.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, on rebuttal, if you could, if you're able to, will you tell us what other federal jurisdictions, under what theory cases such as this are prosecuted or defended? If you're able to, and if you're not, that's fine.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not familiar with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel for the government.
May it please the courts. My name is Captain Todd Kutchenfall, and together with Colonel John Miller, I represent the United States government in this case. Appellant's pleas are proper for two reasons. First, appellant's actions place his victims at risk for acquiring HIV, a disease for which there is no cure. There is more than a fanciful, remote, or speculative possibility that his victims would acquire HIV. Second, the magnitude of appellant's aggravated assaults was immense. HIV results in grievous bodily injury and eventually death. Nothing said in appellant's court-martial contradicted any of this.
Now, the article says likely to produce death or grievous bodily harm. Likely.
Yes, Your Honor.
The doctor says a number of things, but among the things he says is it would be very, very unlikely, among other things. Now, why isn't that a matter inconsistent with pleading guilty to doing something that is likely to do something? If the doctor says it would be very, very unlikely. Now, there's other parts of the doctor's testimony that says, yes, it's possible, and indeed, in front of the very, very unlikely, he says he could have transmitted HIV this way. But if I understand appellant's essential argument is not would he win if contested or how would this have been resolved, but the judge at that point should have been on notice to say to somebody, well, which is it, doctor? Is it very, very unlikely, or is it more than some odd definition that this court's created?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you understand the question? Because I'm running, I'm still off on my fanciful trail.
Yes, Your Honor, yes, I believe I do. Taken as a whole, what Captain Wallace, the doctor, testified to, though, was two points I think bear notice that Captain Wallace indicated that it's unquestionably possible for appellant to have passed it on. And he backed this up by citing specific cases where other individuals with similar low viral loads.
Fair enough. No question that meets the fanciful definition. But what is your response to the question? Fair enough. But the doctor having said both, should the judge have said which is it?
No, Your Honor. In context of a guilty plea with that substantial inconsistency, appellant, during the province inquiry, admitted quite clearly that he could have infected the two women, that the risk was more than fanciful, more than speculative. During Captain Wallace's testimony, he introduced nothing which contradicted anything that was testified to earlier by appellant. I mean, taken as a whole, entirety of Captain Wallace's testimony indicated that it was possible, it was more than a fanciful, more speculative possibility that appellant could infect either one of the two women, and that again, that this is not something which is theoretical. Captain Wallace identified cases that he was aware of where, again, HIV-infected individuals with viral loads similar to appellant had infected their sex partners, and women who had given birth to children had passed on the virus to their children.
Is our jurisprudence at odds with the plain meaning of the statute?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. Again, it's not an issue that I...
That's a follow-on to Judge Baker's question. The statute says likely. It means likely to produce death or grievous bodily harm.
I would say no, Your Honor. This court has always taken HIV cases as a little different. And they've,
are you saying that we've treated HIV as sui generis?
Yes, Your Honor, yes.
In doing so, have we ignored the plain meaning of the statute?
I would, court is not, I would, it's not an issue that I would say the court has ignored the plain meaning of the statute, Your Honor. I think they've recognized that I think this court in the past has recognized that HIV surely is, it's different than other types of aggravated assault. Whereas you see the Bellinton test, which was, mentioned whether it's put in some other HIV cases, where that if the magnitude is extremely high, then the risk can be lower. Because we're dealing with something HIV that there is no cure for it.
Well, let me change the scenario a little bit. Let's take it away from HIV and have it be that someone has a Colt 45 with bullets in it, and they aim it at someone and they pull the trigger. You would agree that that could be aggravated assault whether they're hit or not, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, let's change the scenario. So now instead of having proper ammunition for a Colt 45, the load in the bullet is so low that there's a 1 in 450,000 chance that it could create any harm whatsoever. It would have to hit someone in the eye at a particular angle. Would that still be aggravated assault?
Under that hypothetical, Your Honor, potentially it could be. Given, though, that, again, HIV cases are treated a little differently. If the magnitude of aggravated assault is viewed as being extremely high, that will justifiable risk. And, of course, as this court has said before also in U.S. v. Clark, for instance, it's not a question of the statistical probability. It's merely the probability that the risk is more than fanciful, remote, or speculative. So
we'll add to the scenario that I just came up with that, you know, I'll stipulate that even with the lower load in the bullet, if it does hit someone in the eye at the particular angle, it's going to kill them. Mm-hmm. Absolutely no question.
That hypothetical, Your Honor, if the evidence is indicative that would be true, then I guess an aggravated assault in that case, yes. Again, it's not a question of the probabilities of this in HIV cases, or it's not a question of probabilities, it's not a question of statistical probabilities. It's merely a question of, is it more than a fanciful, remote, or speculative possibility that the risk of the virus in this case will be transmitted?
The word likely has a number of definitions, does it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you wish to offer one to us?
Your Honor, the only definition that...
I suppose it's fair for you to say, please read the case law. But the dictionary, or a dictionary, this is the game of dictionaries now, among the definitions is within the realm of credibility, plausible.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that how you would read likely? Or would you read likely as displaying the characteristics that make something probable? Or does it matter in this case?
Not necessarily in this case, Your Honor. Just getting back to what Captain Wallace testified to, it's clear from what he set forward in the pre-sentencing portion that that it was more than a likely possibility that the virus could be passed on. Given again the documented cases that he mentioned, it was not something that was theoretical, a person in Helen's condition passing on the virus. This was something that has happened before. It can happen in the future. It easily happened here.
Does the record tell us whether appellant was aware of his low viral load?
It does, Your Honor. Captain Wallace indicated during his testimony that appellant was aware of his condition. It's in the record, Your Honor.
Counsel, is the following the government's position with respect to the statute and the manual and the case law? And I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I'm trying to sort it out. That likely means something more than fanciful. And that when the manual and the case law talk about natural and probable consequences, it's not talking about likelihood there. It's in the context of if something is likely, then the natural and probable consequence would be death or grievous bodily harm if one of those likelihoods transpires. Therefore, if in a statistical case, if the statistics show that it is likely and the testimony shows that the natural and probable consequences would be death or grievous bodily harm if that likelihood occurs, then there's the statute is fulfilled in the manual and the case law. Is that the government's position?
Yes, sir. I think that's a fair reading of the manual. So that is the position that the government is setting forth here today, Your Honor.
Counsel, there still is a little problem with the definition of risk as this court has defined it in our prior cases, and that gets back to the fanciful, speculative, or remote. And in this case, it appears from the doctor's testimony that this was not likely. I mean, it was possible, so it probably wasn't speculative or fanciful, but it was remote. So how do we deal with those three prongs to that definition? Are they either or? Do we have to hit all of them? How do we deal with that?
Your Honor, the way the court has looked at the three words of the test in the past is that they are basically one test, that in order to be more than fanciful, more speculative, it would be each of the three words basically meaning the same thing, Your Honor.
So even if it is remote, if it's not fanciful, it's okay.
If it's, yes, the court concluded that it is more than a fanciful possibility, then by definition, it would also be more than a speculative or remote possibility.
Counsel, I'll ask you the same question that I asked appellant's counsel. Are you familiar with how this type of behavior, this type of offense, is treated in any other jurisdiction?
Your Honor, I am not.
Or how the question of the relevancy or impact of the viral load plays into it?
No, Your Honor. There wasn't. No, I'm sorry.
Okay, I'm a little perplexed as to why neither of you would have looked at that, but that's fine.
It's more questionnaire, and there's not a whole lot out there from other jurisdictions that would really be on point for this court to help on this matter.
Okay.
Well, and would you agree with the appellant that the issue here is one of matter inconsistent or not?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you think that's a fair, that's the question we should be addressing?
I'm sorry, sir. Can you repeat the question?
It's not a sure question, but is the essential question presented to us today, notwithstanding the full range of questions about the definition and so on, is ultimately whether there is matter inconsistent during the plea inquiry?
Yes, Your Honor, that's the question. That's the focus here, that whether or not the judge should have reopened the provenance inquiry based on what Captain Wallace testified to, if there was a matter inconsistent.
So what case should we look at? Oh, excuse me, I interrupted your answer. Please finish.
I'm happy, but are you happy?
Yeah. Well, happy.
What case should we look at when we're dealing with the following proposition? That the matter that is set up in sentencing would not provide a legal defense, but would be a matter that would be considered by a fact finder in determining whether someone is guilty or not. If that matter, in other words, take this case. Let's assume that the evidence that was set forth in testimony on sentencing would not provide a legal defense. The appellate defense counsel asserts it is nonetheless inconsistent with the testimony that was presented by the accused in the plea inquiry. Not asking to concede that it was inconsistent, but for purposes of measuring whether it's inconsistent or not with respect to a guilty plea, what's the best case for us to look at from our precedents in assessing whether a matter that is not a complete legal defense is nonetheless at issue for purposes of assessing whether a inconsistent matter has been set up with respect to the plea?
Your Honor, again, I'll just say that initially there was no matters here which should be termed as being.
I'm not asking you to concede that at this point or agree with it. I'm saying in for us to assess whether or not it was, what case law would you point to for us to look at when we're looking at a matter that's not a legal defense, but rather a matter raising facts which could be considered by the fact finder on the issue of guilt or innocence? When does that circumstance during sentencing require a judge to reopen the guilty plea?
Your Honor, it's something that I'd be happy to cite to you. I don't have a case name off the top of my head that I can put forth at right this very moment.
Okay. We're not asking for a supplemental citation.
If there are no further questions, I will go ahead and conclude. Appellants, please reply. Place this victim is at risk for harm, and the magnitude of the harm they face was both real and immense. For an affected person, HIV can still result in grievous bodily injury and eventually death. Nothing said at this court martial contradicted any of this. For the reasons articulated here today, this honorable court should affirm the appellant's conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government. Excuse me, counsel for defense. Do you have rebuttal?
I think what the court was trying to ask me is this two-pronged test that they've established for likelihood, is that inconsistent with the statute? And frankly, I didn't really consider that issue. I do read the concurring opinion in Weatherspoon, where Judge Efron is saying that he's concerned now that they're establishing this two-pronged test that really didn't exist in the past. But either way, you do have the doctor there saying that it's very unlikely for a parent to transmit the HIV virus. So whether it's whether death or grievous bodily harm must be the probable consequence, and that is the only problem that this court adopts. Essentially, the doctor is saying here that it is not the probable consequence.
What is your response to the government's argument that, one, the doctor's testimony ultimately did not contradict the appellant's, and two, the doctor's testimony taken in whole says that it's possible but unlikely, which is different than saying it's unlikely.
He says very unlikely, right? Sure.
But, right.
Yes, and even taking that.
He even uses actual words.
Yeah, even
would have, but very unlikely.
Yes, Your Honor. Taken as a whole, the doctor is saying that the probable consequence of death of grievous bodily harm is not going to happen from a parent having sexual intercourse, especially when he uses a condom. That's what you get when you take the doctor's testimony as a whole. And the doctor, the government sort of mischaracterizes what the doctor says. He also says it's unquestionably possible. But then he goes on to say, when someone like a parent who has a viral load like a parent does in fact transmit the HIV, that is a remarkable situation.
So you don't disagree with the government that you should look at the doctor's testimony as a whole. It's that you take a different message from the...
No, I'm just answering the government's argument.
I understand. But
once he raises a substantial inconsistency, I think the military judge does have a duty to reopen the problem.
I think it's an important question, though. Do you disagree with the concept that we should look at the testimony as a whole? Or are you saying, no, you just look for particular words and pull them out and say, aha,
inconsistent? I think even if you look at the doctor's testimony as a whole, the military judge still have a duty here to reopen the providence inquiry.
Okay, no, fair enough. I understand that position, but do you disagree
that you
look at it?
I think the court should look at the testimony as a whole.
Counsel, let me ask you the same question I asked the government. Which case should we look to in a circumstance where there would not be a defense, as you had argued earlier in this case, but there are facts that are raised on sentencing which are arguably inconsistent? What case do we look to determine whether there is an insufficiency, an inconsistency worthy of reopening the providence?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't cite a case in the court.
Can't cite a case, okay. Isn't that the heart of what we're talking about here today?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
In conclusion, Your Honor, the appellant admitted facts and introduced evidence that are substantially consistent with the means likely to produce death or grievous bodily harm. If I ask this court to reaffirm a finding to assault consummated by battery. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be adjourned until next week. Thank you.
The court stands adjourned until further order of the court.